Bah! Humbug!
Christmas is a bother. The noise, the crowds. I really wish it were outlawed.
How can they talk about Santa Claus when there's so much unhappiness in the world?
Poor misguided folks. They missed the whole point. Lots of unhappiness? Maybe so. But doesn't Santa take a little bit of that unhappiness away?
Oh, I think he does. So does Santa Carlson. Welcome, everybody, to the radio program, a record of the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI.
That was a good start, but I had something else in mind,
guys. A new holiday was born. A Festivus for the rest of us.
What's today? The 23rd, right?
Today 23rd. Is the day that Festivus is observed. Is that
indicating we got a lot for the show, Mr. Carlson.
We have our aluminum pole up here somewhere in the studio.
Jerry Seinfeld would be very proud of you guys. All right. Boy, do we have, again, unprecedented. We don't have a nice, slow, let's talk about the holidays for 3 hours. No, we've got a packed program. We could easily be doing a five-hour show in the next 3 hours because of everything that is happening. And we're on top of as much of it as we can be. And your comments are always welcome here. The radio program of record, the John Carlson Show, this and every single day of the work week when it's not Christmas week, from 6 to 9 a.m. Go ahead, give me a shout at 206-421-5757. That is the same number you can use for texting or for calling. That's 206-421-5757. Well, as we talked about last Friday, police finally made an arrest in the man suspected of stabbing a Metro bus driver to death in the U District. I take that back. He was still at large when we were on the air on Friday, but
yeah. Mm-hmm.
They had sightings of him. He was basically just roaming around the city. And you know how he was roaming around the city? On Metro buses. Richard Sitzlak was just hanging out on buses. And that's where they caught him. Talk about poetic justice. They end up catching this guy on a Metro bus on Saturday. Here's Karina Vargas with some details how this all went down.
I recognized him immediately. Like, I had the police bulletin in my pocket for 2 days, doing my best just to remember what he looked like, any facial features, just what he was wearing, anything he was carrying. But, like, I saw his face. I'm like, that's him.
Police say a witness reported to police that the suspect was seen riding the E-line. And as soon as Timothy got the description, he said he made the call after noticing him in the back of his bus.
He was asleep all the way in the back while all this was happening. He had no idea what was happening.
Timothy said he was both relieved but filled with anger about the murder of Sean Yim, who he says he grew close with.
He just was always really nice, always good with a joke or a quip or something like that, and just really caring.
Transit union leaders say it's been a hard few days knowing someone dangerous was roaming the streets. According to court records, Richard Sitzlak was arrested in November 2023 for the murder of his roommate, though prosecutors say there was not enough evidence at the time to disprove his claims of self-defense. Sitzlak is being held at the King County Jail and is expected in court as early as Monday afternoon. In Seattle, Karina Vargas, Como News.
Okay. It's something else very interesting is this bus driver who was, again, just making his rounds when he looked in the back in his mirror and this guy, Mr. Sitzlak here, Richard Sitzlak, had jumped on the bus. He got on in the middle of the bus. There's, of course, buses that are the doors at the front and doors in the middle. He got on when the middle doors open and just went to the back of the bus and fell asleep. The bus driver, Tim Nelson, is a young father of three in his mid-30s. He used to take a Metro bus in to work. He would take a bus to get to his job driving a Metro bus. Do you know who drove the bus when he went to work in the morning?
No.
Sean Yim.
Whoa, so they crossed paths many times before?
They knew each other.
Okay.
But he was his bus driver. And so this Metro bus driver, again, you heard Karina's report carrying the guy's picture just so if I spot this guy, I can do something. And sure enough, there he was. This was before dawn on Saturday. The same time frame that where he was on the bus early Wednesday morning when he got into an altercation with the very easygoing Mr. Yim, 59-year-old Metro bus driver. And Mr. Yim finally just pulled the bus over and asked this out-of-control guy to leave, and instead the out-of-control guy flew into a rage and pepper-sprayed Mr. Yim, pepper-sprayed the bus driver, and then yanked him off the bus and pulled him several feet off the bus and stabbed him in the chest. And Mr. Yim ended up dying in an alley a few feet away. So naturally, everyone is looking for this guy. And there he was at the back of Mr. Nelson's, Tim Nelson's bus. That was about 3rd and South Main Street when he saw a police car. And he slowed the bus down, opened the front doors and motioned to them, and then just pointed in the back and said, "I think that's our killer." And the police laid out a plan real quickly, and other police officers and Metro employees sprang into action and arrested Sitzlak without incident, by the way. He didn't fight it. Of course, he was kind of roused from his sleep and wasn't in a position to do anything aggressive. So good police work, a good work. Mr. Nelson, that'll be a memory he'll carry with him to his dying days. There's a story for the grandkids. How Grandpa helped catch an accused killer. Again, we keep saying alleged killer, but it's pretty obvious, I think, what actually happened. All right, so that's updating the story that on Friday's show, you know, police knew who this guy was. They knew he was hanging around locally. They just hadn't picked him up yet. I said, just a matter of time, and took less than a day for them to finally scoop him up. Now, while we're talking about buses, we have an attempted murder on a Pierce County transit bus. Was hit by gunfire in downtown Puyallup, of all places. And it wasn't, you know, at 3 in the morning. It was right at 5 in the afternoon. Right along South Meridian Street near West Stewart Avenue, Puyallup Police Chief Scott Ingalls says the two suspects are both juveniles. Bus hit by multiple bullets. No passengers were injured. Again, that's just fate. That's just luck. Good fortune on their part.
Target practice? Are we going after somebody, or
who knows if it's that, or it's a, you know, some sort of a initiation into a gang? Who knows? But more details again from Karina Vargas.
I recognize them immediately. Like I had the police.
Oh no! Oh, for heaven's sakes! Okay, this is Puyallup Police Chief Scott Engel, but it sounds like, Phil, that this is the Metro bus driver Mr. Nelson. Okay, I think we've got the wrong clip here. Go ahead. This is Scott Engel, the police chief of Puyallup.
And immediately upon stepping off the bus, one of the subjects draws a weapon, handgun, and fires multiple rounds at the rear of the bus. There was no physical altercation on the bus. There were no exchange of words on the bus. According to the victim, the subjects were simply looking at him during the ride.
Phil, do we know anything about the victim?
I don't think that they've said. That would be a great question, though. I mean, all this happened last night, so I'm guessing some of the investigative stuff is still getting sorted out. But yeah, that would be a fine question. But downtown Puyallup, quiet little downtown Puyallup.
5 o'clock afternoon, we're out shopping. Yeah. It's Sunday before Christmas. Unbelievable.
And again, someone on the bus says that those two were there. There were two juveniles on the bus, and they said there was no interaction, no conversation, let alone any argument, let alone any fight. And they get off the bus, and they start firing at it. So let us hope that they get these shooting suspects behind in custody, and let's hope they're not given an ankle monitor, for crying out loud. This is getting ridiculous with juveniles. All right. What a busy weekend. The President of the United States speaking at Turning Point USA's conference. I think our man in the afternoon, Ari Hoffman, was there at that conference. And boy, was there a lot of energy. Turning Point USA is the largest and most robust, most dynamic, and most influential young political organization in the country. And they had their annual conference over the weekend in Phoenix. Donald Trump was there, and Donald Trump made it clear that on one of the signature issues of his campaign, remember they criticized Kamala Harris over and over again for her extremism and her party's extremism on transgender ideology, running a clip of her over and over again. We didn't see it so much here in Washington because Washington was going to be voting for the Democrat, was going to be voting for Kamala Harris anyway. We voted for every Democrat for president going all the way back to Michael Dukakis in 1988. But Kamala Harris they showed a clip of her saying that taxpayers should pay for the transgender surgeries for illegal aliens who are in custody for committing crimes. And if they wanted to convert genders, we should pay for that. They played that ad more than any other ad, Team Trump, during the campaign. And Donald Trump made it clear, hey, that wasn't just to win an election. We weren't just running that ad. We were letting you know, as Donald Trump, the tagline in the ad would say, her pronouns are they, them. Donald Trump's pronouns are you. Here's what he said over the weekend.
With a stroke of my pen on day one, we're going to stop the transgender lunacy. And I will sign executive orders to end child sexual mutilation. Get transgender out of the military and out of our elementary schools and middle schools and high school. And we will keep men out of women's sports. And that will likewise be done on day one. Should I do day one, day two, or day three? How about day one, right? Under the Trump administration, it will be the official policy of the United States government that there are only two genders, male and female.
One of these days, we're going to look back on the last several years of what I agree with Donald Trump is just transgender madness. And we're going to say, can you believe there was actually a time in this country when our elites, our liberal elites, tried to divorce gender from biology? They tried to separate out your gender from biology. That male private parts and an XY chromosome no longer demarcated that you were male. And a double X chromosome and female private parts no longer meant that you were female. That everything was just a floating spectrum and you are the gender that you believe that you are. And if you want to compete on the girls' sports teams in high school or the women's college team, and you're biologically a male, that's irrelevant. It's what do you think you are? What do you consider you are? Never mind all the natural advantages you have as, say, a swimmer or a track and field athlete or soccer player. Never mind all of the built-in advantages you have. It would be a civil rights violation not to consider you a female if you consider yourself a female. Biology be damned. We're going to look back and say, what the hell were we thinking back then? And of course, it wasn't what we were thinking. It's what our elites were thinking. It is about time, high time, we pushed back on this. And a lot of courageous young women and girls, the Riley Gaines of this world, they deserve so much credit for leading the way on that. And the American people are behind you. Usually the Republicans, conservatives kind of shy away from culture wars. Oh, this is one that we should jump in with both feet and push back on. And it's going to happen. And boy, is it ever time. Past time. And it's also past time for me to have Philip J. Vandervoort III with our first social media sweep of the week coming right up as The Commute with Carlson continues. Talk Radio 570 KVI. Good morning.
Did you get the free screening real quick when Apple TV Plus decided to open it up here?
Well, the answer is no.
Okay.
And so we said, well, let's just watch on demand. It's got to be available somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
It ain't.
No.
So are you ready for this?
Yeah.
We have made that such a tradition at the Carlsons that my son and I jumped in the car and started driving around places to see, hey, do you have the DVD of Charlie Brown's Christmas? We found it at one of the few Barnes & Noble's brick-and-mortar stores. Yeah. This is Crossroads area of Bellevue. They had two copies. And we grabbed one. It cost $20, but at least now we'll never be held hostage to Apple TV's scheduled showings of Charlie Brown.
Real quick notice of all these years, you know, I'm only 25 years old. Has anybody noticed that Snoopy's doghouse is blue in Merry Christmas, Charlie Brown? Every other show.
Change colors.
Halloween,
it was red, right?
It's red.
Yeah. That's good catch.
Too much home improvement at the Christophers.
All right. Philip J. Vandervoort III, what's going on in the social media world?
Something that I think you're going to get into a little bit later on the show, and this is how the Wall Street Journal has ended up picking off and doing a deep dive on all these examples of how national news media went to great lengths to basically ignore and absolve President Biden with any of his signs of cognitive health decline. And on Friday, a long time, I think he was with the Washington Post for the longest time. I don't know if he's still with the Post, but he's doing his own thing politically. Chris Cillizza.
Yes, formerly the Washington Post.
Yeah, formerly the Washington Post. He made an out-and-out apology because as a reporter, he said he had a confession to make. He should have been pushing harder earlier for more information about Joe Biden's mental and physical well-being and any signs of decline. Meghan McCain, hardly a fan of Donald Trump.
Not a fan
at all. Yeah, picked up on this about this admission by Chris Cillizza as this Wall Street Journal report was getting ready to drop. And I think a lot of the political insiders in the media in Washington, D.C. realized they were about to get cooked, as the kids like to say.
Yeah.
Meghan McCain pointed out Chris Cillizza's confession and said, when I say this is too little too late, I mean this is absolutely pathetically too little too late. There was no bigger and more obsessive McCain truther regarding my dad's age when he ran in 2008, and that was when my dad would have been 71, than Chris Cillizza, and he ignored Biden because he's a hack. So, you know, not somebody who's on the standard conservative side of the ledger, Meghan McCain pointing out all these flaws in the political reporting world as well. The social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. And one more here. Reason.com is pointing out that California's recent $20 minimum wage hike for fast food workers did not create jobs, as was claimed, and even
cost jobs.
By one report in the University of California, Berkeley, a research paper by two labor economists. And they say you have to read through the 25-page study, but what's omitted, they say, is that data show that the minimum wage increase reduced California fast food jobs. So all this chatter about, the fast food restaurants, they'll absorb this, or they'll be able to absorb the costs of the $20 minimum wage, turned out not to be true, just like we were trying to tell everyone. It would cause problems.
Well,
so you actually have people losing jobs.
I think our listeners know that you have, more than most people in radio anywhere, have been banging on this drum that, hey, this minimum wage, all it does is cost jobs. All it does is reduce hours.
Yeah.
And the net effect is not that great at all.
When the price of a commodity goes up,
for employees,
you will almost always use less of it.
But it makes the progressives feel good about themselves because they can say, look what I did. I raised the minimum wage from a distance. That's what the words look like on paper. And we don't need to look into the details.
And they really don't like fast food corporations or companies or restaurants.
31 minutes after 6 o'clock in the morning, the John Carlson Show. Oh, my goodness. A number of Democrats not at all happy with their own party. And are they finally being candid about it? Wait until you hear this coming right up on the commute. We are the John Carlson Show. Talk Radio 570 KVI. Mark Christopher playing that is... kind of a, not a rain dance, I guess we can call it a snow dance.
Yeah, I have yet to do it.
He so wants there to be a white Christmas, and it's so not going
to
happen.
NOAA just sent a note yesterday to me, National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration. 4% chance of snow Christmas Day, Seattle. I still have my snow dance to do.
I was going
to
say, it'll snow on Christmas. You just have to be up around 4,000 feet in the Cascades.
If you have to be on Mount, if you're on Mount Rainier, you'll have your white Christmas. All right. A number of Democrats are being very candid about the state of their party. A couple of them are still in office, like Congressman Adam Smith. Congressman Adam Smith says our party's lurched too far to the left. It's out of touch. It's extreme. And then there's the Senator John Fetterman, who, again, is himself very much a liberal. And he says, hey, look, you know, our party's just gone bajork. I mean, it's just completely lost touch with working class people. And then there's Joe Manchin. Joe Manchin, when he got into politics in West Virginia, many back in the 1970s is when he first started getting involved in politics there. Democrats ruled West Virginia. Democrats were still seen in the 70s as the party of they used to say the little guy. And the working class. And so that was Joe Manchin. That was his background, and that's the party he felt comfortable with. And he's not leaving Washington, D.C. as a former, as an outgoing U.S. senator and a former governor of West Virginia. He's not feeling like a Democrat anymore. He has formally now left the party. And he's being very clear. He says that the Democratic Party of today, its brand is just toxic.
The brand got so bad. Mm-hmm. The D brand has been so maligned from the standpoint of it's toxic.
Now, he was having an interview in a bar with CNN's congressional reporter Manu Raju. And he explains, you know, his own gradual migration out of the Democratic Party and what it took to make that happen.
The Democratic Party, the Washington Democrats, have tried to mainstream the extreme.
How would you describe what the Democratic brand is right now?
I like how he said that. They've tried to mainstream the extreme.
In a couple of words, what is the Democratic brand?
You know, it's basically infringement on me making decisions. And let me tell you why. The Democrat I grew up being, they wanted to make sure the people had an opportunity for a good job, a good pay. They would make sure you got a decent pay where you have some benefits and you can enjoy your family and make sure you had a safe working condition. That was one of those things. Okay. That's all. They never infringed over and, oh, you can't live your life that way. Or you can't say this. You can't do this. I mean, there was a fairness in
it. You think it's changed?
It has changed tremendously. Mm-hmm. They have basically expanded upon thinking, well, we wanted to protect you there, but we're going to tell you how you should live your life from that far on. It's the mindset of the left, the progressive left, which was always a minority. In West Virginia, the Democratic Party is perceived for more attention and more resources to people that are capable and able-bodied that won't work or don't work than those that do.
Again, they pay more attention to those who don't work or won't work than those who do. Anyone care to make the case that he's wrong? His Senate colleague, Kyrsten Sinema, who is leaving the U.S. Senate, she served a single term in Arizona and chose not to run for re-election. She also left the party. She declared herself an independent, not, you know, as she was walking out the door, but while she was in the Senate, which was very interesting because she was seen as kind of a quirky, crunchy kind of liberal. Someone who had admitted to being bisexual, and someone who, again, was had been a member of the Green Party years ago, but who it became increasingly conservative. She never became a conservative, but she went from the left, the quirky left, to being a centrist, which means that she was moving in a rightward direction during many of her years, her single term, in the Senate. She and Joe Manchin came under harsh criticism for blocking the renomination of a progressive leftist to the National Labor Relations Board. The Democrats really wanted that appointment to happen because they want to control the National Labor Relations Board within the Department of Labor. It's a key panel. It's a very important appointment. They wanted to control the NLRB during Trump's presidency. And now that Lauren McFerrin, who is the progressive in question, will not be renominated, they didn't have the votes because Manchin and Sinema wouldn't give them the votes. Donald Trump will now get to nominate two new members to the National Labor Relations Board. The Republicans will now control the NLRB. And she said that, and she's come under harsh criticism from the entire Democratic Party, Bernie Sanders and others. And she said, hey, look, I don't fit into a box. She said, some people think I'm an enigma, but that's not true. I'm highly predictable. And removing myself from the partisan structure of an increasingly partisan town, she says, that's true to who I am and how I operate. And she said at least one Democratic senator, who, of course, didn't want to go on record, said she was right to, among other things, stand up for the filibuster. And she said, well, what about all of your critics within the party who are very upset with you? And she said, I don't give a blank about their disapproval. S word. So those are two. You know, one Democrat, a conservative Democrat, Joe Manchin. One Democrat, a centrist, but a stubborn independent, Kyrsten Sinema. Now let's go to Cenk Uygur, who also made an you know who he is, right, Philip?
Young Turks.
Young
is
Turks.
His claim to fame. That's the way I always put it.
He started Young Turks, which was seen as the go-to place for young progressives. And even he has had it with the partisan left in his own party. He showed up at Turning Point and had a conversation on stage with Charlie Kirk. Here's how their conversation went. He got a standing ovation. Again, the leftist host of the Young Turks broadcast gets a standing ovation from the young conservatives at Turning Point.
If you agree with MAGA 5%, the answer you get is welcome, right? Come join us, right? On the left, if you disagree 5%, they go, get out of here, you're a right-winger, you're a fascist, right? But if you push enough people out and you guys welcome enough people in, eventually you win the popular vote. That's what I warned them about, and that's what happened, right? So, look, I propose simple rules, the three rules of the internet. Rule number one, when we disagree, we fight. There's nothing wrong with that, right? Now, rule number two is, afterwards, we must have a beer together, okay? And rule number three is, for God's sake, when we agree, let's unite. So, for the left, we have too much division. We almost never unify. I don't mean with the right. I mean internally. The left loves to attack one another.
Yeah. And you've got, you know, Pramila Jayapal saying, oh, the reason we lost, we didn't go to the left far enough. We didn't go further to the left. That's why we lost. Again, they have learned nothing. They never will. They're not driven by reality. They're not driven by facts and evidence. They don't care about the results of their policies that are failing so badly. Again, it's all about the ideology. And that's what's driving Pramila, and that's what drove the Democrats to defeat. Again, progressives like that became Donald Trump's secret friends, secret allies. It's 48 minutes after 6 o'clock in the morning, The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Good morning.
Christmas songs that were never hits. Any guess on this voice, Phil? Anybody?
Not off the top of my head. I'm getting no clues.
The Monkees.
What? The Monkees?
Compliments of Christian and, let's see.
That's not
Jonathan Nesmith, sons of Michael Nesmith, produced this.
So who's the singer? It's not Davy Jones. It's not Mickey Dolenz.
It's been released. There's an official music video. Look on YouTube.
Huh. It was his dad, Michael. Anyway, it is 7 minutes to 7 o'clock on The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. A huge outrage overnight, waking up to this. The Biden Justice Department, at the same time they filed a death penalty charge against Luigi Mangione, the alleged assassin of health insurance executive Brian Thompson, while his Justice Department is filing a federal death penalty charge against him, Joe Biden commuted the sentences this morning of 37 of the 40 men on federal death row. He wants to prevent Donald Trump from allowing these executions to go forward. Again, these are men, all of them men, who have been convicted. They received due process, convicted of capital offense, on federal capital offense, and received the death penalty. And 37 of the 40, he's commuting their sentences, including Brandon Basham and Chad Foulkes, who escaped from prison and then killed two women while on a 17-day crime spree. Daryl Lawrence, who killed a police officer during a bank robbery, commutes their sentences. They will now do life in prison without parole, the possibility of parole. But he left three men on death row. One of them was Robert Bowers, who shot and killed 11 worshipers at the Pittsburgh Tree of Life Synagogue. The second is Dylan Roof, the white supremacist who killed 9 black people at a church during a Bible study 9 years ago. And Zokar Tsarnaev, the 2013 Boston Marathon bomber. In other words, these three particular cases got publicity and became national stories. So we better go ahead and not commute their sentences, but these other cold-blooded killers, let's prevent Trump from being able to allow their executions to go forward. Nothing wrong at all in terms of controversies over their charges or whether they're guilty or anything like that. He just wanted to, again, in his dying days in office, throw a wrench into the gears of the justice system. Just outrageous. It is 4 minutes to 7 o'clock, hour number two of The Commute with Carlson. Straight ahead.
Oh, yes. Mega Million numbers come to mind for a drawing. That's going nuts.
No, but what I want to do is remind everyone. Now, you weren't here when we talked about this on Friday, Mark. But we thought we'd have a little holiday fun our last show before Christmas, which is Christmas Eve. Today, on Friday, I said, think about your favorite, maybe not even your very favorite, but just one of your favorite Christmas songs that did not become a big hit. Okay, a song you really like, but you don't hear it 27 times. between Thanksgiving and Christmas.
But enough that if you hear it on radio or
you might hear
playing
it once, once or twice, you'll hear it.
And you won't tune out. You're like, you know, I kind of like this. It wasn't a big hit, but it I can relate to it. Okay.
And so on Friday, I said, okay, everyone think about a song you really like about the holidays that didn't become a big hit, but you still look forward to hearing it, maybe go out of your way to find it. Maybe you even bought, you know, the 45 or the downloaded the song or listened to it on Spotify. And so what we're going to do in the 8 o'clock hour.
Something tells me I'm running a lot of stairs down to the library of KVI.
we're going to ask you to, for the next hour, tell us the song that you really like to hear during Christmas, even though it wasn't a huge hit, what that song was. So give us a shout. You could text your song, your favorite song, at 206-421-5757. And then at 8 o'clock, I will share a song that I love hearing during Christmas, even though some years I don't hear it at all, and a couple of years I'll hear it, even though it was a hit when it came out more than 30 years ago, and it's been covered dozens and dozens of times, but it's not a song that you hear all the time. It's maybe you might hear it a couple of times.
I like it. Good idea.
So far, I haven't heard it at all. Mm-hmm. So I went out. I subscribed to Spotify. So I listened to it every few days during the holidays on Spotify.
Peter Frampton did a nice instrumental of a favorite Christmas song. I'll start with that when we go to break here at about 23 after the hour. If you want an example of a song that's just, wow, Peter Frampton did that?
So, no, there are those songs. It might be someone doing a cover of a song that you really like, and the cover, the version you like, isn't getting much play. So anyway, go ahead and tell me a song that you really like during Christmas that you just don't hear very often. Because it's not like, you know, there's like 20 songs that you hear over and over and over again. You know, All I Want for Christmas Is You. It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas. There's Perry Como. We call him Perry KVI. White Christmas, of course. Last Christmas by George Michael's Wham, whatever they recorded it under. I mean, all of those, you know, Rocking Around the Christmas Tree, you hear that five or six times a day. Okay, Jingle Bell Rock by Bobby Helms. Those songs are already embedded in the holidays. We hear them all the time. What I'm wondering is, you know, a song that you really like that you just don't hear that much. Okay, so Phil, you'll have your choice. Mark?
I'm thinking of one. I just want to see if I can rack my brain to come up with one more.
Okay. And you can either call us or you can text us your song, 206-421-5757. Okay. You've heard me say this several times. My favorite guy in the incoming Trump administration is Tom Homan. Tom Homan is the guy who is in charge of the border. And when I say the border, I mean all aspects of the border, which we'll get into in a minute. But he, too, spoke at the America Fest event put on by Turning Point USA, the huge young conservatives organization, over the weekend in Phoenix. And here is what he told the crowd.
What Joe Biden had done by unsecuring the border is this. Sex trafficking up over 600%. Known as suspected terrorists, people on the terrorist watch list, well over 300 apprehended. President Trump, in 4 years, we had 13. We ended catch-and-release Joe Biden's released at least 8 million illegal aliens in this country in violation of federal law. And I said it before, for the millions of illegal aliens that have been released in this country in violation of federal law, you're going home, and Tom Homan's going to make sure that happens.
Okay. He sat down for an interview with Tucker Carlson. And the reason I like Tom Homan so much is that he is the perfect appointee. Perfect appointee. Number one, he knows the issue upside, downside, sideways. He knows more about the issue and the law than virtually anyone. He knows about the issue because he has spent his life trying to secure the American border. He has worked in Democratic administrations and Republican administrations. Believe it or not, the Obama administration actually gave him an award for how well he was doing his job. So, and the third thing is that he has the drive, he cares about the issue, and, you know, you sometimes can know a lot about an issue, not care a lot about an issue. He cares a lot about the issue, and he's driven to reverse the course of the last 4 years. He's driven to make results happen. So here's Tucker Carlson interviewing Tom Homan on his very popular podcast, asking him what his priorities will be.
Can you summarize in one sentence what you plan to do with the job?
Well, look, we had a discussion that night, and he gave me three rails, three things he wants me to do. Number one is secure the border.
Yeah.
Shut the border down. Number two, run the biggest deportation operation this country's ever seen. And third, he wants me to lead an effort to find the over 300,000 missing children that were trafficked into this country, and this administration cannot locate them.
300,000 children brought across the border that they cannot account for. 300,000. 300 should be a scandal. 300,000? You know, that's the population of Bellevue, Kirkland, Redmond, and Spokane combined. 300,000 children in this country they cannot find. Tucker Carlson, known, of course, throughout America as the second smartest Carlson in all of news media, asks for details. And Tom Homan, more than happy to oblige.
Seal the border, deport the illegals, find the missing children, right. 300,000.
Yes.
Let's go in order. Seal the border. What has happened? Do you have a sense now, over a month after Trump's victory, of just how big the invasion was under Biden? Do we know?
Well, we know that we can document over 10 million encounters, 10.5 that we can document. Then we can document over 2 million gotaways, right? These are known gotaways. What is a known gotaway? These are people we capture an image on drone, video.
Is that in addition to the 10?
Yeah. So
at least 12 million people
have been encountered at our border. 10.5 been encountered. Over 2, we know they're a gotaway because we capture on drone traffic, video traffic, or sensor traffic, and Border Patrol is over 1 that couldn't respond. So we know there's at least 12.5 million people at that border.
So that's like New York plus Chicago.
It's a historic number, which is one of the reasons why I wake up pissed off every day, because we went from the most secure border in my lifetime. I started in 1984 as Border Patrol agent, worked for 6 presidents.
Where did you start, by the way?
I was born and raised in Campo, California, San Diego sector.
Yep.
But to go from the most secure border of my lifetime under President Trump, based on data, right? That's just my opinion. That's data. Go from the most secure border of my lifetime to historic illegal immigration in one administration. That's by design. That's not mismanagement.
Yeah.
That's by design.
What do you think the goal was?
You know, I asked that a lot of you, why would anybody open a border up? I think Joe Biden's the first president in American history who came in office and unsecured a border. I worked for, you know, six presidents. Obama and Clinton took steps to secure the border because they understood you can't, possibly can't have, you, there's no way you can have strong national security. If you're on border security, you need to know what's coming in, who's coming in, where it's coming in, why it's coming in. Joe Biden's first president came in office and unsecured a border. And people ask me all the time why. I think they see a future political benefit. I think they see, think these people would be future Democratic voters, number one. Two, but we don't even have to get there, right, Tucker? I mean, when Biden signed over 90 executive orders getting rid of everything we did, he also overturned the Trump census rule, where millions of illegal aliens would be counted in all these sanctuary cities, which is going to result in more seats in the House for the Dems and reproportionate seats in the House.
Can that be undone?
Oh, yeah. I think President Trump needs to get, when he gets back in, when he needs to establish the other census rule, illegal aliens should not be counted in the census.
Well, yeah, because illegal foreign citizens, non-Americans, should not be able to determine how many members of Congress you have and where they sit.
Exactly.
And right now they are counted. Right now they are counted. So, again, I love how he put this. Joe Biden is the first president in American history who unsecured the border, and he did it on purpose. And you bet it was all about politics. The politics, by the way, blew up in their face. They thought that all of these folks coming across the border, many of whom were brown-skinned, would actually help them win the Latino vote. That it would help them. Say, look, more people like you coming across the border, because the Democrats are obsessed with race. Guess what? Hispanic voters reacted exactly the same way that every other voter reacted, which is they were repulsed. They were angered at people cutting the line and streaming across the border and wrecking entire communities, making America more dangerous, overrunning social services, creating all sorts of problems in school districts. Lots of new students who don't speak the language, and there's no accommodations for that. Human trafficking, not just drug trafficking, the crime. And again, the Democrats knew all that was going to happen. The Biden people knew this was going to happen, and they kept doing it anyway. Again, you heard Holman, 10.5 million people encountered at the border, and another 2 million got away in 4 years. That's more than the population of Washington State and Oregon combined. And by the way, it's not just the southern border.
How many came through Canada? Do you know?
I don't have it off the top of my head, but I know the number, depending on what sector you look at, is 600 to 800% increase on the northern border, specifically in upstate New York, where I grew up. And I still have a home up there, so I'm very familiar with that area, and I talk to Border Patrol chiefs up there all the time. Northern New York, it has a huge problem. And the problem with northern border, a lot of SIAs come through the northern border. They can afford to fly to Canada and cross the northern border, which is wide open because there's a lot of border and very few agents. So a lot of Indians, a lot of Pakistani, a lot of Turkish come through the northern border.
And that's where you have your national security threats. When they fly to Canada and travel south into the United States, because there's a whole lot of border and not many border agents, that's where your national security threats are likely coming in, through the northern border. We'll hear more from Tom Homan, his interview with Tucker Carlson, a little later on the John Carlson Show. It is coming up on 21 minutes after 7 o'clock. Philip J. Vandervoort III right around the corner with a social media sweep. A busy morning on the John Carlson Show. Talk Radio 570 KVI. Okay, that's one of our more annoying Christmas songs. I think that's Spike Jones. It's got to be Spike Jones.
Yeah? One of a kind. All right. One-time play.
All right.
This song makes my gag reflex induce.
However, when I lost my two front teeth, right. I heard this over and over again when I was 7 years old. We okay.
Yeah, there you go.
So what we're doing is we are asking you, we're going to do this at 8 o'clock, to tell us your favorite Christmas song that you don't hear often during the holidays because it was never a big hit. But you like hearing it, and it doesn't usually play very often during the holidays. So I've got mine. Phil's got one. Mark's got one. What is your favorite Christmas song that never became a hit and that you don't hear three or four times a day between Thanksgiving and Christmas? All right. With that said, it is 26 minutes after 7, time for the social media sweep. Philip J., what's going on?
Got some news from Seattle here. The social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. You talked about it in the first hour of the show, your opening segment. Seattle police finally arrest the stabbing murder suspect of a Metro bus driver in Seattle's U District from last week. And that suspect is 53-year-old Richard Sitzlak. Now, Como, you know, you covered some of the story from what Como covered earlier on the show. King 5 ended up speaking as well with the bus driver that realized the suspected murderer was in the back of his bus.
Yeah.
So King County Metro bus driver Timothy Nelson had been trying to keep track of this story because he knew Sean Yim, the bus driver who was murdered last week in the U District. And
he
Timothy
knew him well,
Nelson,
and
yeah,
carried,
they knew each other.
Carried a picture of the accused killer
suspect
in his shirt pocket,
yes,
so he would be able to, if he came on right his bus, he would be able to say, yeah, that's the guy. Right.
And here's what Tim Nelson told King 5, quote, I knew that he was armed and dangerous. I was very anxious, apprehensive. I was really on edge, really nervous. I didn't know what was going to happen. He was fast asleep in the back like everybody was circling around the bus and getting ready. I think he means the police there, getting ready while he was just passed out in the back. And he said, I was excited they made the arrest, but I was also really angry. He killed a bus driver and then he felt comfortable enough to get back on a bus and fall asleep. Maybe it's all he knew how to do, but it still hurts. So some pointed words there from the bus driver who discovered the suspect in the back of his bus and was able to alert police. Last week...
And by the way, that wasn't the only bus he was seen on.
Right.
Another bus driver said, no, he's on my bus too.
Now, last week, the King County Prosecutor's Office patted themselves on the back and announced that they had charged 34 felony criminal cases against 17 different defendants for spray paint graffiti tagging in and around Seattle. And I don't know if I'm the only one who does this as you drive down I-5. The I-5 corridor is probably one of the most prominent spots for this, but you'll recognize the spray paint names, the tags, over and over and over because there are some that are so prolific. They're constantly spray painting and tagging all kinds of different places. So I had seen reports last week that the prosecutor's office made this announcement about, okay, 17 defendants, we've rung them up on felony charges for spray paint graffiti tagging. But what I didn't know until I read a post that was on CapitolHillSeattle.com, which is kind of like a blog for Capitol Hill Seattle News, was that three really well-known names that come up a lot when you look at the spray paint graffiti tagging, G-Ride, or Gride, depending on how you look at it, but G-R-I-D-E, Wesh, or Wesher, and .com. And I will say that I've seen the tag G-Ride on I-5 down in Fife, on some of the overpasses down on I-5 and Fife, at 405 and I-90, of course, through I-5 in Seattle, and even up into Snohomish County, I've seen that G-Ride tag. So that's somebody that has now been charged, going to face felony counts for all this.
I like that, felony charges. Stuff, that, right? that is good, because they've done a lot of damage.
But look at what range these spray painters have. I mean, it's not just
well, who's
in
stopping
one neighborhood.
Them? Until last week,
yeah.
Who was stopping them?
Yeah. And I think it was a couple of months ago, maybe 6 weeks ago, I had a story on the sweep where Kent police, on a tip from Seattle police, arrested a guy, and they found spray paint cans, and they found the harness that the person was using to drop down into these more difficult-to-reach places. So the 17 defendants being charged and some very well-known ones based on the prolificness of all this graffiti tagging based on those names.
When we come back, I will have the cure to graffiti. I will tell you what the cure is to graffiti. Here's how to make sure it goes away. That's coming right up. Our last show before Christmas on the John Carlson Show. And yes, we are going to mark the Christmas holiday by allowing our listeners to share with us your favorite Christmas song that you don't hear very often, and neither does anyone else, because it never really became a big hit. And I asked Mark Christopher, radio legend, Philip J. Vandervoort III, senior chief executive producer of The John Carlson Show, and yours truly, we've all picked one song that we really like that we don't really hear a lot during Christmas, but we like it. So I'm asking you to pick one as well, and then text it to us. Tell us what it is, and we'll play a little riff of it if we can find it. I don't know how
quickly we can search, but yeah,
Mark
Christopher we'll try.
Is running up and downstairs between here and the basement to try and find the KVI Art Christmas Song Archives and whether it's there. But we'll do our best, right? So text us your favorite Christmas song that never became a big hit. 206-421-5757. That's 206-421-5757. Now, if you're just this moment joining us, where you been? The show's half over. But never mind that. Right before the break, Philip J. was talking about how they are finally, after years of doing nothing about graffiti, they have charged, was it three people, Phil?
17 total.
17 total?
Yeah, 17 defendants and then 34 different felonies.
Okay, have been charged with 34 different felonies because of the sheer amount of economic damage done by these serial graffiti artists. Okay. And I said, when I come back from the break, I'm going to tell you how to make graffiti go away forever. First, a quick question. To those of you who drive between the East Side and Seattle, notice any difference when it comes to graffiti? When you go to Bellevue, there is no graffiti. Now, do these graffiti, quote, air quotes, artists, do they not know how to get to the East Side? Do they not have transportation? Of course they do. But they don't tag in Bellevue. And here is why. It's because of what I call the Kemper-Freeman rule. Now, I've known Kemper for almost 40 years. And when I'm not doing this radio show, I am VP for government affairs for his company, Kemper Development, in Bellevue. And you would think Bellevue Square, Lincoln Square, Bellevue Place, all these stores, all these restaurants, all these, you know, different places would be just ripe for a graffiti artist. But it doesn't happen, and here's why. Going all the way back to Kemper's father, they have what they call the 24-hour rule when it comes to graffiti. If they, and this again, we're going back to the 50s and 60s, if they spot any graffiti on their property, it's gone in 24 hours. Or as Kemper Sr. used to say, if it's there in the evening, it's gone by sunrise. Because one of the things they realize is that these taggers, these graffiti activists, they love showing off their work to other people. They like to say, look what I've done. Look what I created. Look, that's now, everyone has to look at that now because I did that. And so the Freeman family policy was, well, don't give them that joy. Don't give them that benefit. When graffiti would appear, it would be reported. And if they had to send a crew out in the middle of the night, they would do it to scrub the graffiti off just so that when the graffitiists came back the next day, all their work was gone. All the effort they put into their graffiti was gone. And some of them do put in a lot of work. So after a while, you know what happened? By the way, if they caught someone, they would also file charges. They would not shrug their shoulders and say, well, kids are kids, etc. No, they would make sure there were clear consequences to what they were doing. So clear consequences plus your graffiti being gone made graffiti a whole lot less fun. So they stopped. And this was many years ago, and that standard has held. They said, Bellevue, yeah, don't. They'll just erase it. Now it'll be gone in a day or two. Now there are some areas outside the retail Leviathan that is downtown Bellevue's, you know, Bellevue Square, Lincoln Square, Bellevue Place. There are areas outside that where they have graffiti, but they usually take care of that as well. But if the city of Seattle, in conjunction with King County and in conjunction with the state, particularly the Department of Transportation, which is responsible for the freeway walls and the overpasses where you see all this graffiti, if they all got together and with the private sector, like say the Seattle Downtown Association and the Seattle Chamber, said, when we see graffiti, we're scrubbing it. It's gone. It will be finished. It'll be out of here. It'll be vanquished. Pretty soon, you won't see much graffiti in Seattle anymore. That's all you would have to do, is have a concerted effort that whether it appears on a private business, whether it appears in a public plaza, whether it appears on a metro bus, whether it appears on a freeway wall or an overpass. It disappears. It goes away as soon as possible. And will it cost some money? It'll cost some money up front for a while. And then you'll see the graffiti begin to disappear. It really will help if you toss criminal charges at someone who is caught doing this. And the ideal sentence for them would be 6 months in jail or 600 hours of graffiti removal.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a good starting point. Do the removal of the graffiti. The other thing that's so bizarre about this is that the Seattle Politicos
just 60 hours of graffiti
decided
removal.
To ignore this with the response that, oh, you know, it's just artistic expression. But there's nothing artistic about it because it's just about putting your own handle out there.
You know what that is?
Your tag. There's nothing artistic about somebody scribbling or writing their name in spray paint.
There's
no artistic value or merit, whatever.
That's the rationale that city and county officials created to explain why they're not doing anything. Well, you know, come to think of it, that public nuisance, that graffiti, you know, it's not all bad. Some of it looks pretty nice. You know, these people really are artists. They're creating. They're expressing themselves. That's the rationale.
Just, yeah, going and branding their name on somebody,
that
on
has
something.
Been invented
explain
why they're not taking action. That, you know, come to think of it, it's not so bad after all. Yeah. It's a tolerance policy on intolerable behavior.
And it was a cop-out for allowing it to keep happening.
So anyway, if you want graffiti to disappear, that is how you do it. All right, it's 46 minutes after 7 o'clock. When we come back, I want to return to Tom Homan. He is the guy in charge of the border, all things the border, meaning secure the border, carry out the biggest mass deportation program in American history. And he explains what his priorities will be there. And find 300,000 missing children. When we come back, Tom Homan talks about the drug cartels and how, under the Biden administration's deliberate policy of unsecuring a border that was perfectly secured, better secured than ever in American memory since we had a border policy. They unsecured a border that was formerly secure. What this has meant in terms of the power of the drug cartels, all that straight ahead. The John Carlson Show, and a reminder that we are asking you to tell us your favorite Christmas song that didn't become a big hit. It may have been a small hit for a little while, but a song you love hearing during the holidays that you don't hear often because it wasn't a huge hit. Text us that song, 206-421-5757. It's 48 minutes after 7 o'clock, The Commute with Carlson. A lot of great sentiment in that movie. All right, it is 52 minutes after 7 o'clock, or 8 to 8, here on our last show before Christmas. Tom Homan, who will be Donald Trump's point guy on the border, having a conversation with Tucker Carlson about just how bad things got when they opened the border, how many problems were created. Here he is talking about now the power of the drug cartels south of the border.
Do you think that the fentanyl traffickers, known as the cartels, I guess, I'm not exactly sure what that means. I'd like to ask you, actually. But you keep reading and hearing that they have control of parts of the southwestern United States. First of all, what is a cartel? Who are they? Where are they from? And do you think that's true?
Well, the criminal cartels in Mexico, they are born out of the narcotics smuggling industry in Mexico, and they're powerful. Look, they're like a Fortune 500 company.
Yes.
They're just not a gang anymore, right? Yeah, Jalisco cartels, they're in over 45 countries of the world, right? And not only are they responsible for moving narcotics in this country, they're currently in every major city in the United States, because not only are they smuggling the drugs in the United States, they're taking over the distribution within the United States, yes. Right? So again, and I said this at the RNC, and President Trump agrees with me. These criminal cartels have killed more Americans than every terrorist organization in the world combined, right?
And every war, more than the Second World War.
So that's why they need to be designated terrorist organizations and wiped off the face of the earth. And it's going to take the United States to do it. Mexico has failed to do it, even if they tried to do it. Bottom line is much of the Mexican military, much of the Mexican law enforcement, much of the Mexican government's corrupt. That's just a fact.
I love it. Someone who just takes an unvarnished look at the facts and says, here's what we have to do, and here's the reality. We're going to have a tough time working with the government of Mexico. He pointed out that in years past, they were cautious about sharing information with the people they hired to do the vetting of people we worked with in Mexico, because they even didn't have a measure of trust to that level. So anyway, I love having Tom Homan in this job. I think fentanyl trafficking is going to go down. Sex trafficking is going to go down. I think they're going to find the whereabouts and rescue a lot of kids. I think crime is going to go down. I think illegal immigration is going to go down. This is a very good sign. One of your Christmas presents is a better, safer, more secure America in the person of Tom Homan. We could be grateful for him. When we come back, your favorite Christmas songs that didn't become hits, but boy, do you like hearing them when occasionally they turn up. Text us your favorites, 206-421-5757. Here come your 8 o'clock headlines, The John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. All right, I tell you, we were so taken aback by the massive response to what was a suggestion of, hey, you know, we've never really asked people, and you don't often hear people asked on radio, what's a Christmas song you like that never really became much of a hit?
Some of the greatest ideas.
Maybe a little hit.
And this is a compliment to you, Mr. Carlson. You had this idea as you were grabbing coffee and you just saw the door open and said, guys, I think I just thought of something that might be kind of fun. What do you think?
And boom. So we got to remember that for next year, because that's all the time we have for this morning's show. I just want to tell you, in our last show before Christmas and Hanukkah, which begins on Christmas night, did you know? So
that's right.
I hope you all have a wonderful, wonderful holiday season and a very Merry Christmas to all of you. I will be back on Friday. We're going to give Philip J. and Radio Legend the day off. So I'll be here with Young Zach on Friday's show. And then the following Monday and Tuesday. But off tomorrow and off Christmas and the day after. So I hope you have a wonderful, joyous Christmas. I am so grateful. What am I grateful for this Christmas season? I'm grateful to the wonderful team we have here. And I'm very grateful for all of you. Thank you for spending your mornings with me right here on 570 KVI. Let's talk again on Friday.